Hello, this is Anthony Pascal.
And this is Laurie Elster.
And this is All Access Star Trek, the new TrekMovie.com podcast all about the Star Trek universe on television.
Today we're going to review the second episode of Lower Decks, but first we want to get to the news because there's actually a lot of it. Tony, I think we should start with the Alex Kurtzman interview that was at Gold Derby, which is an industry sort of entertainment site. And I know he gave a good interview there about Emmy Awards and nominations, and that led into a lot of information we didn't get before at Comic-Con.
Right. It's interesting because, you know, in this interview, he said a lot more than we got in the Star Trek Universe panel, even though it was, you know, just an Emmy interview. The biggest bit of news, and I wouldn't call this official news, so this is, let's call it quasi-official news, is he was talking about COVID and how things are going, and he was saying what everyone's working on, and he said that they were already writing for season 4 of Star Trek Discovery.
And while we know, like, there's been no news on an actual renewal or anything like that, but it's pretty clear that you wouldn't be paying writers to work on it unless you thought you had a shot at it, or it had, you know, with an approved budget, basically, for at least that part of it.
Right. You know, sometimes networks will give people money to go ahead and write scripts before the full green light. And it's also possible that they've been given kind of a soft green light, but that CBS is waiting until season 3 debuts in October to actually announce that they're going to do season 4. I think they announced the Picard season 2 shortly after season 1 debuted. I think the same thing with previous seasons of Discovery. So,
well, with Picard, as I recall, they told us that before it premiered, that there were going to be 2 seasons. Oh, again, you're right. It wasn't officially announced. You're right. It was the same kind of thing. They gave it to us in an interview when we asked, but it was not officially announced yet. So it's exactly the same kind of thing.
Right. This is the thing that we've been through before with something we know versus something that where they send out a press release. Like Strange New Worlds had become a one of the worst secrets in Star Trek by the time they officially announced it in May, right?
Yes. Right. And now we actually have a little more information on that too, right? From that same interview?
Exactly. So he just simply said that he expects the show to start shooting in 2021.
Which means they're already, which we knew, well, working on scripts and stories and might be a little farther along than we thought, perhaps.
Yeah. It shows a level of confidence that they're going to be able to get back into production in Canada, at least. And we talked about this a little bit last episode. So mark your calendars for 2022 for that. Because if they start in 2021, there's no way they can get it out the door in the same year, realistically.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. He talked about some other shows, too, sort of loosely touching on the 2 animated series.
He brought up the kind of irony of working in COVID and how it has a big impact on the live action shows. You know, Discovery went into Discovery's elongated post-production, which we don't need to get into detail. But he said the opposite of that is true for the animated shows, both Lower Decks and Prodigy, revealing that both shows are already underway on their second seasons. And we knew that for Lower Decks already, but this is kind of our first confirmation that Prodigy, which doesn't debut until 2021, has a 2-season order.
Which I think that's important for fans because people are so wary of investing in shows that are going to go away quickly. So it's a smart strategy.
Yeah, it's more, much more common with animated shows because of the long lead time, but it's good to know. We actually, not part of this interview, we actually got a little bit of other Prodigy news this week. CBS announced a hire, which isn't someone that was hired this week, but they...
I hope not.
Exactly. But they announced that a guy named Ben Hibben, who's an award-winning director and producer, is working on the show. He's the creative lead of the show. And, you know, it's funny is when you look back at his Twitter, even though it was announced this week, he was already kind of talking about the show as, you know, during the Comic-Con panel. So he's been working on it for a while, but the important thing is he's a really talented guy and well thought of in the worlds of animation. So it's just a, you know, a nice hire, and it's good to see more talent for Star Trek Prodigy.
And I know there was more stuff from Alex. I was especially interested in what he talked about with Short Treks, which was sort of the premise of the interview, because they got an Emmy nomination for Short Treks, for short form series.
Right. And he's actually nominated for that. So nominally, yes. This was the reason why he was doing the interview. And he talked a lot about how the show's been experimental and lessons learned, which I think is good. What was interesting about the future, and we've talked about this in both of our last podcasts, is what's next for Short Treks, which was essentially a stopgap measure while they're waiting first on, you know, the second season of Star Trek Discovery. Last year, they did some more experimental stuff. With so many shows in development, do they still have a place for Short Treks? And it sounds like we were right that there isn't anything happening now for Short Treks, but he's still hoping that there will be, and he's pointed to the nomination to say maybe the nomination will spur on more Short Treks development, and he wants to do more experimentation, and he threw out a couple crazy ideas there.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, just overall, I'm happy to hear this. Even when I haven't liked all of the Short Treks. I've loved some, disliked others, but I like that they're experimenting and trying new things. And yeah, he did bring up two particular things he thought were worth experimenting with. One was the idea of a musical, which I have to say he's got the talent for it already on the casting sheet. So I see fans asking for it all the time. And I think it's one of those things people would be very, you'd get people who are very angry about it and other people who just loved it.
Right.
The cast is up for that one for sure, though.
I think, are you talking about the cast of Discovery, for example?
Yeah, specifically the Discovery cast. So we have some good musical theater vets, and we know that they just love singing and dancing on set in general, and they did that. They've done some singing already and some promotional stuff, so I would be all for that. Bring it on.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting idea, I'd be glad if they did it as part of Short Treks. That's a good one. And he also suggested doing something in black and white, which I thought was interesting. And of course, when he said that, my immediate thought was to how Robbie McNeil and Garrett Wong have been talking seriously about bringing back Captain Proton.
Yeah. No, they've been looking into it. They want to do it. When I interviewed Kate Mulgrew for a Trek movie a while back, I asked her about that. And I was very surprised that she was really into the idea, because she loved being in those episodes. She loved playing Queen Arachnia. She said it was the most fun she had.
And I recently talked to David A. Goodman, who's been a writer and producer on Star Trek Enterprise and Futurama. He wrote the Star Trek episode of Futurama, and he's now on the Orville as an executive producer. And he and Robbie have talked about this. So this is not just some crazy idea. I mean, they've actually talked about this, and Goodman told me that if he ever leaves his contract at Fox, if it ends and he doesn't renew it, which could happen next year, he said his first phone call will be to Alex Kurtzman. And the first thing he's going to pitch is some Short Treks ideas he has, including this one. So he's all for it.
The last piece of news I think we got from Alex was that they're still talking about the rarely mentioned Section 31 show.
Exactly. Section 31 is something that was announced a couple years ago, and eventually the plan was, a pilot was written, and the plan was for it to go into production, at least a pilot for it, this year after the third season of Discovery wrapped up. Now, it wrapped up in February, and then we all know what happened.
So did everything else. Yeah.
Exactly. Now, a lot of people were taking the, well, we haven't heard anything from them on Section 31 as somewhat, you know, perhaps ominous news for Section 31. Even though every press release that CBS sends out about Star Trek always throws it in there at the end to say it's still in, quote, development, which is a real word in Hollywood, which is different than having a series order like Strange New Worlds. So it still doesn't have a series order, but Alex said they are still writing for it. And last year they talked about there being a writer's room. So it seems like they're writing additional episodes for what would be a Section 31 series. And that still could be a thing. Obviously, they're very keen on Michelle Yeoh. She's a big part of the third season of Discovery. And it's a big question mark of how she would get out of the 32nd century and into whatever century the Section 31 show is set. But it's almost certainly not the 32nd, right?
Right. Right.
So,
but it's Star Trek. There's always a way to do that. But yeah, they would need a very good reason that she doesn't bring the rest of them back with her.
Exactly. Exactly. And which is, you know, been a question we have about the third season of Discovery is now that they're in the future, they're going to need a good reason to stay there. Because the whole reason of going there was to keep control from the sphere data. If people can remember way back to season two of Discovery, you know, once they're there, they need a good reason to stay.
Right.
And, apparently Mir Georgia may not have a good reason to stay.
Right. Tilly's just trying to stay away from her mom. That's why she's staying.
So we got a surprising bit of news, out of just one interview. It looks like the next big opportunity for news is going to come in the first week of October. There's been an announcement of an official Star Trek Universe panel for what would have been New York Comic Con, but now is going to be called New York Comic Con Metaverse, and it's going to be online for obvious reasons.
Yeah, that made me just a little bit sad because I have been going to New York Comic Con for the past few years and covering the Star Trek panels and really enjoying the adrenaline rush of all those interviews. But online, at least, there's no waiting in line and schlepping anywhere. And they actually are doing something different from San Diego Comic Con because the panels are live this time, right?
Well, that's what it seems like from the press release, that all the New York Comic Con panels will be live, interactive, so fans could ask questions. Hopefully this also applies to the Star Trek one. Most of the San Diego, or what was called Comic Con at Home panels, including Star Trek, were pre-recorded, heavily edited, and, you know, as we discussed in a previous podcast, that kind of sapped the panel of spontaneity.
We do have some movie news, and we normally wouldn't be covering movies in this podcast because we're focused on the Star Trek universe on TV. But one, it's kind of big news, and I don't think we can resist talking about it. And two, it does sort of tie into our looking at the overview of how Star Trek is being handled in general. But Tony, this is your sweet spot. You are the movie king. So why don't you talk about what's going on?
Well, we are TrekMovie.com, of course. So, you know, we can't help ourselves. We were born.
Exactly.
The site was born talking about the new JJ movies. And anyway, what's happened is Paramount has hired someone named Emma Watts, who has a really good track record at Fox. And she's now the head of the motion picture group at Paramount. She started in June, I believe. And she shows up and, you know, sees that there's three Star Trek projects at various stages of development going. One of which is the one we've been reporting on over the last year, which is the Noah Hawley project. That's the guy from Fargo. One of which is the Quentin Tarantino project, which everyone was talking about a couple years ago, but seemed like it wasn't really happening as much. And one of which was the project that was supposed to start shooting at the beginning of 2019, but got stalled because of salary negotiations, which was the sequel to Star Trek Beyond, which would have included Chris Hemsworth as George Kirk, reprising his role from the 2009 movie.
They'd even lined up a director for that one.
Right, exactly. I mean, that was that thing was happening, and you know, meetings were happening, and but your Paramount just didn't want to pay as much as they thought they were going to be paying before Beyond came out, because they kind of redid everyone's salaries, and they had these negotiations, and Chris Pine basically said, pay me what you said you were going to pay. And they're like, well, we've cut the budget, so can we pay you less? And he said, no. And Chris Hemsworth, you know, and Chris Hemsworth said, I'm Chris Hemsworth, so no.
Right.
And
he's more Chris Hemsworth than he's ever been before, for sure.
Right. He gets more Chris Hemsworth every year. So
thanks to Marvel.
Now, but this is all old news to Emma Watts, right? Because she just showed up and she sees these three things. And so everyone was thinking the No Holly project is the new thing, and that was probably going to involve a new cast and be a whole new story, although there's some indications it might have involved the Kelvin crew as well. But the word on the street from the trades, and Deadline started this all rolling, is that the story involved a pandemic storyline. And I think bad timing! So, you know, that's just not exactly what people want to see in their sci-fi optimistic fantasy right now, perhaps. And now it looks like the Hemsworth project is moving back into the front of the line. So maybe Paramount's money situation is better, and she feels like it might be worth dropping some cash to get both Chris's back on board and get the Star Trek franchise into that kind of global tentpole position that Paramount has been lusting for since they brought in J.J. Abrams, right?
It's interesting that they're still keeping all of this very, very separate from everything that's going on TV.
Well, that's kind of the interesting subtext to all this, is that ViacomCBS now is putting a lot of time and effort and money into what they're calling the Star Trek universe. But the Star Trek universe isn't a Star Trek cinematic universe. And I don't want to get too into timelines here as much as just the way the companies are thinking of these things. And so far, it doesn't look like Paramount has pivoted to integrating what they're planning on doing with what Alex Kurtzman and his Star Trek group are doing with all the television shows. For years, Paramount and CBS have functioned on their own for Star Trek. And even though the companies have merged, it doesn't seem like they're now thinking of this as one big thing where maybe they try to do a tie-in with the Christopher Pike show or the Picard show. That doesn't seem like that's currently the plan. Emma Watts has said that Star Trek is a priority, so that they see it as this asset, and she just needs to kind of figure out what to do with it. And that seems to be on her to-do list for this year. And so hopefully by the end of this year, we will have more idea of the direction of the film franchise. But as of now, it doesn't feel like it's going to be fully integrated with the TV franchise, but you know, that remains to be seen.
Right. That seems like a great time to start talking about Lower Decks itself, because we have a new episode to review.
We've now seen the second episode, which is called Envoys. Overall, what did you think of it?
I thought it didn't move as quickly as the week before, which might be a relief to some people. I kind of missed the crazy rapid pace, but I enjoyed it, and I thought that it had a even more heart than the first one, in a very Starfleet kind of way.
You know, we talked about this heart thing last week, and I definitely feel more and more that this show fits into heartwarming sitcom territory. This episode is written by Chris Kula, who is a sitcom veteran. He's worked on Community. He was a producer on a show I really liked called Wrecked, which is on TBS, which no one's ever heard of. But it was a parody of lost. And I think he understands and thrives in the genre of sitcoms. And you could feel that in this episode. And also, you know, you may have liked the rapid fire of the first episode. I felt that at times they went over the line, you know, and so I'm kind of glad the pacing was a little bit normal this time, if that's a word.
Yeah, and it was very traditional in terms of sitcom structure, like you're saying.
Exactly. Which, right. Again, I don't see as a bad thing. And in fact, you know, in my reviews of the website, I saw some parallels with Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which is one of my favorite sitcoms. I know you're a big fan of Brooklyn Nine-Nine as well.
No, I'm not. I had to watch a few episodes for something I was writing, and I didn't really like it very much. I didn't stick with it.
Well, you're just going to have to take my word. It's a good show, and there are some parallels here to Lower Decks.
Sure, and to a lot of sitcoms that we've seen, I think. What they do is they take something that you're sort of expecting and give it a twist, a spin, whether it's a Star Trek spin or a comedy spin or just a very Lower Decks-y kind of spin, which I appreciate. I like taking subverting expectations.
We saw that especially this week in what now appears to be a function of the show to start with what's referred to as a cold open, which is kind of a comedy bit at the beginning that really has nothing to do with the rest of the show, but is still funny and still has some character moments, but is a kind of a standalone little skit almost.
Right. There are two things I wanted to mention about that cold open. And one was that the transdimensional energy creature reminded me of the one that impregnates Troy in season 2 of Next Generation, flying around and popping into people. And then I also thought that its voice was very Futurama when the alien kidnaps the Star Trek crew in that famous episode of Futurama where they all guest star. It had the same kind of voice and the same kind of agenda almost.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of an over-the-top villain, you know, I will destroy you and all that kind of stuff. So it was fun. And I kind of liked how, you know, maybe this was a little bit of a reaction to the child, which, you know, had this energy being essentially violating Deanna Troi. And now we have these two women seeing this thing and immediately capturing it.
Yes. And forcing it to grant them very nerdy wishes.
Yeah. Although, wasn't it, like, why is Mariner kind of the coolest person in the world asking for a tricorder?
I thought that was terrific because it shows that she really does belong there.
Okay. Don't they just issue those to people? You know, can't anyone get a tricorder?
Well, she is Lower Decks, so maybe they don't get they get the hand-me-down equipment.
Okay. Well, that makes sense.
It was absurd, and yeah, does it make a lot of sense? No. Did it work anyway? Yes.
Exactly, which is kind of encapsulates this whole show.
Yes, it does.
Now, a lot like the first episode, much of this episode was dedicated to this pairing of Mariner and Boimler, who are Oscar and Felix of the show, really.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. And it's what we did get to see was Mariner's softer side by the end of this one. Because she saw how she was affecting him, and it actually got to her for a change. She actually thought about it. I mean, for a change, we're in episode 2, but you know what I mean.
Right. I mean, the show has set up this dichotomy between them of he's all about book learning and studying, and she's all street smarts and quips. And this came to a head in this episode where they're, you know, just on a typical mission of, you know, escorting this Klingon general, and they have to deal with all these different aliens, and Boimler's full of facts, but he can't seem to get anything done.
Right, and he gets beaten down by his inability to succeed at things that he thinks he should be doing well because he's read so much about them. And then when she sees that happen to him, you can see that she isn't feeling superior at that moment. She's actually feeling bad.
She has taken him under her wing. She said that she's going to be his mentor and that he is her chadich. And, you know, that was put to the test because, you know, this, you said beat down. I mean, he was just ground down step by step, alien by alien, until by the end. I don't know if they meant this on purpose, but remember, it's he's so beat down, he throws away his badge.
And yeah.
I thought, well, first of all, it's such a symbol of Starfleet is the badge. But in the last episode, if you remember, Mariner, before she decided that she was going to be his best friend, threw his badge away at one point.
Yeah. So and, maybe that'll be a recurring theme.
Right, right. Kind of like, you know, Jedi's always losing their lightsabers in Star Wars. Sorry, wrong franchise. Okay. but, you know.
That's okay. I do like Star Wars.
So, yeah, it was sweet in this episode of how she kept on trying to encourage him until eventually she even cooked up an extra bonus alien encounter, because all the alien encounters just went really bad until the final one, which she manufactured.
Right. And it's because she saw that her method of knowing everything and just telling him what she knows wasn't working and was in fact depressing him. So it was actually a very sweet thing of her to do, even though, I mean, the audience saw it 10 miles off and Boimler did not, which is funny. But it's I thought that it was indicative of the fact that she's learning and growing.
Right. And she, you know, I mean, we're jumping to the end, but I think it's important as part of this arc of they're back on the ship, everything's done with, and Boimler has his mojo back, and he's telling the rest of the crew all about how Mariner confused a Ferengi for a Bolian, and she lets him have it. You know, whereas, you know, one episode ago, it almost was like episode one, Mariner would have never let him have that moment, right?
Yeah, no, she was making fun of his captain's log and telling everybody about it.
Exactly. So we're already seeing, just two episodes in, some nice character development and some nice bonding between these two, even though they're constantly bickering. And you know, jumping back to the beginning of the episode, the first alien encounter may be one of the most interesting because it just started unveiling more and more about Mariner because, you know, Boimler's so excited about taking this Klingon general down. He's all, you know, he's practicing his Klingon and he's, you know, talking about respect and honor. And we get our first good look at a Klingon. How did you think the Klingon was presented in Lower Decks?
Well, he was a certain type of Klingon, basically a drinking Klingon that we've seen before from time to time. Not your typical Klingon, but just a happy drinking drunk Klingon who likes to tell stories a little bit like when Dax was hanging out with her old Klingon buddies from the original series on Deep Space Nine. Braggy stories.
Right. Here's a little thought experiment. Is imagine this was a human character and it was an Irish person and they were that drunk. You know, so he was so Klingon, he was so extra Klingon, you know, that it almost bordered on, you know, racist, because he's just a what do you think? I mean, if you were Klingon, would you be offended by what a drunk this Klingon was?
I think it would depend if I were a drinking Klingon or a fighting Klingon myself. But I probably would be, now that you think about it. I hadn't really thought about it. I thought it was a bit unusual that he got so drunk that he stole the shuttle and started zooming it around. Which seemed not so Klingon-like. But that's an interesting theory, that it was racist against Klingons.
We're in too deep when we're talking about that. But what's interesting is what he revealed about Mariner, which is that Mariner has this whole backstory with this Klingon, that she worked in something called Gray Ops, and whatever that is, but it's something like Black Ops, but, you know, not as dark, I guess. And she was had a blood bond with him. And, you know, Boimler's like, when did you do all this?
Yeah, the thing he doesn't know that we know is that comes from Starfleet family. So in addition to whatever specific experience she's already talked about, which is serving on different ships and she got demoted and she's been to all these planets, we also know that she quite likely grew up on a starship.
Yeah.
And he doesn't know that.
Right. Because he doesn't know her backstory. But he's constantly learning more and more about her, and it's perplexing him at this point. And I have to admit, like, there's just so much to this character that it's hard to take in at this point. But it almost feels like every episode we're gonna just learn new, interesting, and surprising things about Mariner. Who it makes sense, she is our lead for the show, and she will, of course, let us all know she's complicated.
And then I think that'll make it especially interesting when she starts encountering new things that she hasn't seen before. Because she's going to be thrown a little bit, probably. Because she likes playing the seasoned expert who's seen all this stuff before.
Eventually, we're going to have to see Boimler teaching her things. And, you know, it's still a little one-sided now.
Right.
And, you know, he has things to teach her about protocol and rules, and maybe they're not always so bad, but in this episode,
I was just gonna say, and being thorough, that's something he likes to do. He reads the full reports. He wants to know everything there is to know.
Exactly.
So I do feel like that we'll have a future episode where that does come in handy.
Right, and he actually showed a little bit of that, because in the manufactured encounter with the Ferengi, he was able to work it out, because if you were paying attention early on during the drinking song with the Mariner and the Klingon, he was going through this whole protocol of landing the shuttle. And so he knew that anyone claiming to be a shuttle pilot would have to have these codes, which that knowledge he used to figure out the Ferengi. And I don't think Mariner kind of had that all worked out ahead of time.
No, probably not.
While all this is happening down on the planet,
we have this very delightful story about Rutherford and Tendi.
Right. Mostly Rutherford, right?
Yes. Yes. But I thought it was just a wonderful part of the episode where he is just trying to be the sweetest, nicest guy in the whole world. And so that he can do this thing he's sort of promised her, Tendi, that he can do. He says, oh, I'll just, you know, I'll switch out of engineering and then I'll be able to do this thing. And then he tries out being in a whole bunch of teams.
Right. I mean, Tendi shows a little bit of not paying attention, because when Rutherford says, oh, I'll just completely change careers so that we could, you know, not have to reschedule, that seemed a little extreme.
Right. But she didn't get it. It went right over her head. She didn't get it.
Right, exactly.
That's why he was doing it. She thought he was expressing an interest in some other aspects of the ship.
Now, do you see all of this as a romance or just two kind of awkward, nerdy, science-loving people who just want to have a friend?
I see it as friendship now, and I actually personally hope that they keep it that way. I would like to see them not develop a romance and just show how they can be really good friends. I think Star Trek has always done friendships really well. And it's nice to see a male and female together bonding that way. And it's because they both love science, love Starfleet, love their jobs.
I think that a romance could be a diversion, especially this early. And I love a good Star Trek friendship. You just did a great article about unsung Star Trek friendships with Neil for the site, and there's so many of them in Star Trek, and let's hope this becomes another one of them.
Right. Yeah, I'm not that interested in a romance at this point.
But the Rutherford story also gave us a little bit of a structure to learn a bit more about the ship and a bit more about the very senior officers.
Yes, each department head. And also the whole thing that, you know, Mike McMahon's been talking about this in interviews, but how he wants to make sure that everyone on the ship belongs there. And what we saw in the way that all these department heads dealt with Rutherford was that they were all fantastic. They were all encouraging and supportive, excited that he wanted to be part of what they were doing, and then completely fine with him pursuing his true passion, even if it wasn't with them.
And, you know, I'm not sure if I'm reading too much into it, but they seem to be making a point of this because they would create these moments that seemed like, you know, the chief engineer or Shax or someone is going to just completely start yelling at Rutherford and become kind of one of those angry bosses that you could find in a workplace comedy. And then they just flip it around and he's like, oh, you know, we completely support you, which is heartwarming.
Yeah, they were even cheering, which I thought was adorable and funny. And it was that perfect combination of comedy and heart. Again, they seem to have nailed that tone pretty perfectly.
And, you know, even Dr. Ta'ana, who is certainly the most acerbic character on the show, demonstrated a bit of understanding and sympathy. And, you know, she's the one who recommended, why don't you try out security? Because I think you might be a better fit there. So they were all very supportive and in their own special ways.
I also thought his experience in sickbay was a little bit reflective of Jet Reno on Star Trek Discovery when she was rigging all those people, when she was trying to save everybody, when she was stranded by herself, and she was viewing it as an engineer, the human body from the viewpoint of an engineer, that these are parts that need these elements to keep going, which he obviously has the same strength and sounds like the same lack of bedside manner.
Exactly. All of her patients were unconscious. So that made things easier as she was, you know, playing with their hearts and, you know, various body parts.
Yes.
But
that also, that worked in the same way. It was comedy and heart at the same time.
Now, this whole section of him going from team to team had a lot of jokes in it. And I think probably my favorite sequence of the episode was when he was with Ransom and he was doing bridge command simulations. Those just did not go well at all.
No, they did not. Well, especially for the kindergartners and the pre-Ks.
That was, I mean, I don't know if you noticed, but so as this, as some, you know, helmsman or, you know, I'm not, you know, so one of the officers on the bridge just starts rattling off how various, you know, parts of the education system are now floating in space. You could look on her monitor and you could see little dots leaving the back of the ship, you know, for the children. I mean, it was just brutal.
No, there was, I think, a line, all the ship's children have been injected into space.
You know, there is a debate, of course, in Star Trek, and I don't know where you come down on this, but I always thought it was a little 80s touchy-feely to have families on the USS Enterprise and other Starfleet ships. And in a way, I think they're winking at this to say, you know, having kids on a ship that could at any time go into battle is a little bit questionable, debatable.
Well, debatable is a good word because I could see being in favor, not so much on warships. I always think of it as you do bring your family to an army base, but you wouldn't bring your family to war with you. So it's a
right.
Tough call when you're talking about a starship that's the flagship. I could see arguments on both sides, but in general, I loved that idea, not just because it was touchy-feely, but because it made practical sense to me that you shouldn't have to leave your family behind to have a career in Starfleet and on a starship. I mean, I'm a parent, so I also think as a parent, I bring something unique, just as someone who isn't one brings something unique and a different perspective. I have a specific perspective due to being a parent. So I liked that, even though I didn't have kids at the time when that premiered. Anyway, we can have a whole argument about that separately. But I do agree with you. I agree with you that that was the point of it, was definitely a little wink about having kids on the ship and why it sometimes isn't the greatest idea.
So besides that sequence, what would you say, what was your favorite, funniest moment of the episode?
I mean, I have my overall funniest, best thing was Rutherford with all the senior officers. But my best little one-off moment ever was the Anabage. Is that what it was called? The Anabage?
Right. Anabage.
So the woman in the lovely sarong who tried to seduce Boimler. And then the minute that she turned into that creature, I cracked up laughing. That, to me, was a beautiful, visual, funny moment that won me over completely. How about you?
Although, you know, that was great. And it's nice to see new, you know, that they're creating new species here. This is a new species, and she's telepathic, and I thought it was funny that if she's to be believed, even after learning that she lays eggs in her host's throat and she's this snake thing, Boimler's still kind of into it. She said he still wanted to do some Jamaharone, and I kind of believe it.
Yeah, it was a great tiny little scene.
The humor on Lower Decks continues to show these different kind of levels, I would say. There's very broad humor. I think anybody watching that would think it's funny, because you don't need to know anything about Star Trek. You don't even need to know what Jamaharon means to know what's going on in that scene. So that's kind of a broad thing. But then there's stuff that works just with casual fans. Like there's the joke early on about how, you know, Klingons always have an apostrophe in their name, which is something that Trek fans have kind of noticed as well, right?
Yeah. No, and it's when we saw the preview last week at the end of last week's episode, which with my husband and son, and they are not big Star Trek fans. They're very casual. And that line made them laugh out loud. Right. In fact, that actually makes me want to say something about this show in particular that I wanted to bring up earlier that has to do with the humor, which is that I watched the first episode a couple of times by myself because, you know, we're watching it in advance so that we can review it. But when I watched with my husband and son, my daughter wasn't interested. When I watch with them and they're laughing out loud, it's a much more enjoyable experience. There is something about Lower Decks that makes it better when you watch it in a group. And I know that is particularly difficult these days, but there are various apps you can use to watch things together. And I highly recommend this to people. And I feel like if CBS could do a whole fun campaign and create an app for people to do that, because watching that show in a group, you get this richness and this laughter and these very natural reactions. And I laughed out loud a lot more when I was with other people.
Yeah, doing a watch party with Lower Decks makes a lot of sense. I actually watched one of these episodes in a kind of virtual watch party they did before the premiere. And it was fun watching the chat room and seeing people's reactions to the various jokes on the show, including people who work on the show. And there were people from Discovery there. And the group experience is definitely something that... enjoy Lower Decks with a friend is what we're saying.
Right. And they could, I think, wrap that into a nice publicity campaign for it.
But then there's still within the show some stuff that's just definitely just for the hardcore. Like when they're in the Andorian bar, there were a few things in there that you really need to be a true fan to spot the gag, including the thief who was revealed to be a Vendorian
from the animated series. That was Ted. It was the episode, sorry, was called The Survivor. And Ted Knight did the voice. Ted Knight from the Mary Tyler Moore Show was the uncredited voice. But yes, that was directly from the animated series.
And during the brawl, there was some Andorians with the ice knives, like in, you know, Star Trek Enterprise. So they're dipping all over the franchise to create these, you know, visual references and gags, which I appreciate as a fan.
So do I. I especially like that they brought in Kalons, who I thought they sounded familiar, and then I had to look up exactly which race it was. But it's from the episode with David Ogden Stiers and Michelle Forbes, when they are an isolationist race, the race that they voluntarily committed suicide at age 60. That was a nice deep cut. And they also overall did a nice mix of familiar aliens and new aliens. I don't want to just see familiar ones. I want to see new ones. Introduce me to some new people. And they had some very funny ones to combine.
Right. I mean, the main alien that Boimler was dealing with was something called a Taxor. He tried to speak in its language. That didn't go well.
No.
So that was, you know, so they aren't just saying, oh, hey, remember this, remember this, remember this. I think it's important to introduce us to new things, you know, like right. The Anabaj, obviously.
Yes, my new favorite. I do have one question about something they mentioned that was a good Star Trek reference. I would like to know exactly what the Janeway Protocol is. As a Janeway defender, as a worshipper of all things Janeway and frequent defender, I want to know what that is.
Well, it certainly caused havoc when he called for it, at least in the scenario where they were trying to avoid an asteroid. That obviously wasn't the right call, but I think that they were respecting Janeway, because Ransom said, you know, when it's something like when
time.
He said something like when in doubt or something, you know, use the Janeway protocol, you know, as if it's all, you know, a good idea. It just didn't happen to be a good idea in that one scenario.
Okay. We'll see. Don't pick on my Janeway is all I have to say.
It's nice to defend your favorite show.
She's my captain, I think. But there were, yeah, so that's the mix of regular humor and Star Trek humor and silly humor is working very, very well for me overall. So I think we've pretty much covered this episode of Lower Decks. Before we leave, we each have a little Star Trek tidbit, something we wanted to talk about. Tony, what's yours this week?
Mine was just a little thing I saw online about a company in Mexico which is making these new protective suits for medical personnel who are working with COVID. And the idea came to the scientist behind this from watching Star Trek. And he decided to make these, you know, protective suits based on Star Trek. And I always love when Star Trek is inspiring real world scientists and real world doctors to do something. And we'll put a link to that in the show notes.
That's cool. That's a nice piece of history that Star Trek's always done. Inspired. The very science that inspired it.
So what's your Trek bit of the week?
Mine is an original series throwback. So Ralph Senensky is a director who he did 7 episodes of the original series, 6 of which he got credit for, 1 he didn't. And he put up a website a long time ago, Senensky, SENENSKY.com. If you click table of contents from there, it's a very old school, clearly put together a long time ago kind of website. But there's a whole Star Trek section, and he talks so specifically about everything from the filming and how he set certain things up, the relationships and fights that happen on set, his take on the stories themselves. He has so many, he's worked in TV at that era of TV and did many, many episodes of shows, but his Star Trek information makes you feel like you're really there on set with him. And he did, you know, This Side of Paradise was a big episode that he directed. He talks about, he's the one who cast Diana Muldaur in Return to Tomorrow. And then she was in Is There in Truth No Beauty, which he wanted Jessica Walter for. But there's just so much information from this man, and he's so willing to share his experience. If you're an original series fan, you definitely want to check out his site.
I absolutely will.
It's a cool dude. He's still around.
Wow. There's not a lot of people who worked on the original series at that level still around, so that's great.
Yeah, I think the Inglourious Trexperts had him on as well.
Maybe Trek Movies should interview him. Maybe you should.
I would love to.
Oh, well, let's get on that.
Woo! All right.
Well, I think that pretty much does it.
Yeah, I think we're done. So if you go to our website, you will see links to things that we've talked about, and as well as all the latest news stories, things we've covered, as well as things that are happening while we're recording this podcast that we don't know about yet.
And join us next week. Every Friday, we review the latest episode of Star Trek Lower Decks and give you an update on all the news on the Star Trek universe.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks, and goodbye.